time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit, and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation, all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. Five thought leaders on world peace. Well, this is an extraordinary program, an hour that you'll get a sense today on where people feel we are, where our position is in the world, and what the perception is with all the hot spots we're facing here as a country. Whether it's North Korea, and we see what's happened recently with the president there and meeting Kim Jong-un, whether it's China, and not only the trade problems there, but the buildup of China as a military power, what we're seeing in the Middle East, Iran, of course, and throughout Asia, Europe. So let's get started here at the top of the program here. Welcome on Colonel Jim Worship. He's retired from United States Air Force. He's a career senior intelligence and special missions officer. He served as Deputy Director for Intelligence for U.S. Central Command and has worked on the White House National Security Council. All right. Who is the greatest threat to world peace?
That's an excellent question. And of course, there are many, and you mentioned them in your introduction. From the standpoint of a nation that is just short of almost uncontrollable, I would have to say Iran, because they are so maniacal. And we have watched in the last few weeks some of the things that they are doing and what it takes to try to bring them under control. And while they don't have a nuclear capability yet, they do have their asymmetric capability, which means, you know, they can push out surrogate forces throughout the Middle East, which could cause an uproar within the Middle East. They can reach Israel with their ballistic missiles, not necessarily nuclear tip. But they can create havoc in pretty much the whole Middle East region into Saudi Arabia, throughout the Persian Gulf. So from the standpoint of a flashpoint type of threat, Iran immediately fills the bill.
Well, it's a great point when you bring out the asymmetric capabilities. And that should tell everybody that emboldens even small players, that it kind of levels the playing field a little bit. You have to remember when the colonel points out Iran, any of these smaller places or smaller countries can actually use these other asymmetric capabilities to target the United States. So that's an important point about world peace to start off with. And talking about emboldened, how has President Trump impacted and emboldened other countries?
Well, he's really changing the strategic paradigm worldwide in how he is attending to the various problems and crises around the world. He is not playing the typical status quo. He's not using the old conventional methods that we've seen for the last 40 or 50 years. He's very powerful in messaging, as we all know, which is he controls and dominates the 24/7 news cycle. And that is having a major impact, because he is going out and addressing issues right to the point, right almost to the face of those who he's targeting. Also, the first president who has come out and said, I don't care who you are. I don't care if you're Kim Jong-un. I don't care if you're the Ayatollah. I don't care if you're the head of Hamas. I'll sit down and talk with you. And this is a key thing that people have to really understand with Trump. He wants to sit down and talk to them using a business approach, because he wants to develop two things. He wants to know if he can trust them, if we as a country can trust them. And two, he wants them to prove, key on the word prove, that they are peaceful too, because we hear these countries all talk about, you know, we're all about peace and it's the United States that's the adversary. He wants them to prove that they are adversarial, or they are going to be a threat to others. And so He's putting the onus on them.
The way he has done what you just described there, Jim, has allowed, I think, him to, for these countries, these leaders, to be more emboldened. And the fact, as you say, he's willing to sit down with any one of them on any given day. That's a new tactic for American politics, because we haven't seen that before from leadership. So this is a whole new world order, really, we're looking at here. And it is changing the face of the world, really. Let's talk about China a moment here. Given the growth of China that we're seeing, their economic and military advances, what do you see as the role of China's leadership moving forward? Do you see it as more cooperative or more adversarial?
China has to play this very, very closely. The adversarial approach is not going to work, and they know that, and it's not going to work with Donald Trump. He is forcing their hand, and he's basically letting them realize he's causing them to, in retrospect, look back and say, you know, we can be tough on the United States, but we cannot lose them as a trading partner. We cannot lose them as the number one purchaser of goods and services that we provide. Because if we lose the United States, we have a major unemployment problem in their country, and it's going to be a major effort. You know, you want to talk about Tiananmen Square as well. That would be a whole new type of Tiananmen Square if you have several billion people out of work, or a large portion of that. So they have to play that very closely. The U.S. is their number one trading partner, and that's a key thing. More than their ownership of U.S. debt or anything, they've got to be cooperative. You know, lobbing a nuclear missile or several into the United States doesn't solve any problem. It creates more a problem, because now they still have to exist as a country, and their economy goes down the tubes as well without the United States.
So you see that Trump and Xi being more of a cooperative relationship moving forward. Was the president right to make the recent decision he did on Huawei? That was under a lot of heat based on, you know, obviously, the lack of trust with Huawei, number one, and the technological advances and the corruptness that China possesses. How do you see this playing out, this Huawei deal? And will that, the fact that he gave Xi that leverage, will that help to make this deal happen, do you think?
I think it will. And you always have to look at President Trump from the standpoint, he always has something else hidden. He keeps his cards close to his vest, and he may offer something in return, but you never know what he has got in his follow through. And so I think countries like China and certainly Russia understand that this is a different player on the world stage. And he's still somewhat of a mystery. And, you know,
exactly.
I always tell folks, don't ever hesitate when you see Trump do something and you think, oh, my God, what has he done now? I always say, just wait.
Well, what you described there, Jim, is actually could be a real advantage, a strategic advantage, because you can leverage these relationships a little bit differently than we have in the past. But on the flip side of that, it makes, well, not only adversaries, but his political opponents enraged, because he tackles problems differently and they don't really quite know what to do with that, do they?
Absolutely. I mean, when his main approach, and, you know, we can go back to the Trump doctrine that we talk about from the standpoint of national security, he uses that both domestically, and he uses it in his foreign policy and in his economic way of doing things. It's kind of a multi-phase, multifaceted tactic that is really working. I mean, he has pretty much achieved everything he's wanted, and he knows there's going to be some things that are going to take a little longer and it's going to be tougher. But one thing we can be sure of with him, he's not going to give up. That really bothers a lot of people is the fact that he's not doing it for himself. He doesn't need to. He's doing it for America.
Well, there's always that conflict there, and it's a lack of trust on his opponents. They clearly don't trust the president. Listen, just recently, the president put forth another military branch. This surprised a lot of people. It's called the Space Force. And when you look at, again, our strategic communications, our satellites, so is the Space Force, is space the next military battlefield, do you think? Is that why the president did this?
Space became a battlefield, or what we call battle space, back in the late 1950s with the Corona program, which was our first spy satellite program. That made space a battlefield, so to speak. And what the president did here is a little bit of semantics and perception and certainly strategic messaging. The United States Air Force had a space command. The Army had a space command, and the Navy had a little bit of a smaller type of entity within its ranks. And what Trump did here was bring them together into a unified joint command, which falls under the unified command structure that we already have in place with both our regional commands and other commands like Strategic Command and the Transportation Command, puts it all together under one four-star general or admiral, depending who will lead it, and pretty much combines and really makes it more effective. All the things they're doing, we've been doing, and he also brings in some of the legacy capabilities from NASA. All that will be brought to bear. They have the bases already that are out there. They have the capability. And yes, it answers the question because of the threats and capabilities that other countries are doing. We're watching Iran put satellites up. We're watching India do it. Where, you know, China has been doing it. Russia certainly has been doing it as long as we've been doing it. And it is a battle space. We have to deal with all those things. We talk about EMPs being tossed at the United States and shutting down our power grid and our computer grid. Those are serious things, and what this Space Force will do will deal with those, as well as other types of capabilities of, you know, putting more satellites up to do different types of activity.
Right. Well, that's exactly it. And, you know, when you think about space, again, you mentioned the electrical grid there. There are other challenges we have moving forward. And I think it's important for people to remember that we're in a whole other world today, you know, than we were 50 years ago. And technology is being technologically at the lead in front of these advances are going to be key. If we're not only going to survive, but thrive as a nation, clearly, and remain a superpower status, very clearly. Big thank you here again to Colonel Jim Warshaw. We'll continue on, friends, with the viewpoint and our thought leaders on world peace.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
Spreading the out loud truth from sea to shining sea. AmericaOutloud.com is the voice of liberty and justice for all. The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world. To unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. We are the vision of the voices. Welcome to the new era in communications. America Out Loud Talk Radio. Five thought leaders on world peace. What does it take for us to not only reach for world peace, but to keep our superpower status? And that's, you know, a big question today, friends. I'd like you to bring on now, Baruch Plettner is here. He's an entrepreneur, a scientist, an inventor, and a private pilot. He's passionate about education, the war on globalism. He's the editor-in-chief of Zionism.com. We've been talking a lot about Iran since the president pulled out of the nuclear deal. That's created some challenges. Iran has been very outspoken, and recent headlines of this. If Iran reaches nuclear status, if this happens, what do you think Israel's response is?
Yeah, great to be here. I think that the best response that Israel may be forced to offer is going to be quite a revolutionary one, actually. And that is coming out as a nuclear state, as a nuclear armed state with a full nuclear triad. And that is going to be an exceedingly revolutionary step, like I mentioned, because Israel up until now engaged in a policy of nuclear, inconclusiveness. Maybe that's the word. Israel neither denies nor confirms that it has nuclear weapons, right? Mm-hmm. And that policy dates back to the Kennedy administration. It has a lot to do with how Israel obtained its nuclear arms and kind of had America acquiesce to that, mm-hmm. even though America was always, anti-proliferation, but with Israel kind of never coming officially forward with that, it was...
Is part of the reason, Baruch, the hush-hush on that, is that clearly once one has them in a region like that, then everybody wants them. Is that part and parcel the big reason?
Yeah, exactly. And just the fact that, America has always been against proliferation. So America was always like, well, if a country like, let's say, Pakistan obtains arms, that's bad, bad, bad. Well, nuclear arms, well, why wouldn't it be bad for Israel? So I guess the kind of the tacit agreement was, it's kind of this don't ask, don't tell policy. You know? No, don't ask us, we won't tell you. But that may change if Iran officially obtains nuclear weapons.
Interesting. So that could change that status. That is interesting. You put that out there, and I think I could see that happening, where that would become very pronounced at that point. But then again, that could also create even a bigger arms race in the area, right?
Well, exactly, I think that's the kind of stake that Israel has to over America, if you want to kind of use that kind of language. Maybe it's a little overblown, but nevertheless, it's this thing where Israel has to have some leverage on its own, and it's similar to Japan. Japan also has this kind of thing where, if North Korea, let's say, proceeds with its program much further, we, Japan, are going to become nuclear. Well, Israel, same thing. Israel already, by all reports, has nuclear weapons and the full nuclear triad of submarines, airplanes, and ICBMs, but it never officially says so.
Yeah, interesting.
But it may have to do that. It may have to do that. And yes, it will cause further proliferation in the region, because then the Saudis and so on will say, well, wait a minute now.
That's right.
Even though everybody knew that was the case, but now that that's official, right. What are we, chopped liver here?
So we have that to could something. Be a game changer. You're exactly right. Listen, let me turn a minute to the other part of the world. I want to talk about Afghanistan here. Now, President Trump has made it very clear, I mean, really over quite some time now, that he wants out of Afghanistan.
Yes.
And his actions have shown that. He's reduced troops there. There's been a lot of questions to him. Well, I just recently seen something where he said that we will always have some kind of recognition or force there and keep eyes and ears there. We can never vacate the premise entirely because we have to know what they're doing or what's happening. I do recall that being said. So the question becomes, how do we truly disengage from Afghanistan?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there are any, good options, because I think what will eventually have to happen is that it will be a kind of disengagement that will follow in the footsteps of what happened in Vietnam in 1973. And what happened then was that, Kissinger got the Nobel Prize for negotiating some, as Trump would maybe say, fake deal with the North Vietnamese, and the reason it was fake, because everybody knew, Kissinger knew, Nixon knew, the North Vietnamese knew, and the South Vietnamese knew that none of the provisions of that deal would ever be upheld. And we all know that by 1975, the North Vietnamese took over Saigon, and we had all these, images of Hueys being pushed overboard in American carriers to make room for other people, panic, and in the end, the North Vietnamese won and got the whole of Vietnam under their control. I think something similar is going to happen in Afghanistan. There's going to be some sort of, there are peace talks now, there's going to be some sort of face-saving agreement that the Taliban will agree to this and that. They'll agree to some modicum of democracy to keep some sort of government in place that would guarantee women's rights, this, that, the other thing. None of this will happen. The moment the U.S. leaves, it will be full blown Middle Ages, and you know, so unfortunately that.
It's always the risk. Yeah, it's a definite risk. Well, and you set that up well when you said there really is no win here. There's what does victory really look like? Well, kind of is what it is, isn't it? Now, right? You know.
Exactly. But that doesn't mean that the Taliban will turn around and engage in attacking America. So right. I guess it will still be a win in the sense that they will not attack America again from Afghanistan. But will it be, you know, women's rights and all that? No.
There you go. Yeah. Let's talk about the Chinese a moment here. This is a topic that you talk a lot about. You write a lot about it. So you've studied this relationship greatly.
Yes.
Let's tell folks right now from your experience and opinion, what are the really true Chinese aspirations militarily on a global basis?
I think that, China, I don't think sees itself as of yet as ready to take over, you know, leadership position in the world. I think they think that that's something that they may have to do if America keeps receding from the scene. I think they want to build a blue water navy that can compete with America. They're not there yet. They're not very close, I don't think. But they certainly want to project a lot of military power in their region. So in terms of their global military ambitions, I think that at this point, they're not really very far reaching, or at least not as far reaching as their ambitions in terms of trade. Their ambitions right now are focused on this One Belt, One Road program, where they want to basically draw a lot of countries on the Eurasian continent and beyond into their economic sphere. And I think that militarily, they just want to have enough military oomph to kind of back that program up. I don't really see, and I don't believe that they want to have the kind of military that can, you know, win against the U.S.
Right.
And engage or even Russia. And the reason is they don't have to.
Mm-hmm.
They are so powerful economically and in terms of how many people they have and all that kind of stuff that they don't have to lead with their military might, which is quite the opposite for Russia.
Well, what you say there is interesting because it's really you're saying that they also want world peace, the Chinese. I mean, that's what you're saying, you know.
I think they want it more than anybody else because they depend on it to feed 1.4 billion people.
Wow. That's a great point. That's a very good point. Do you think this trade deal comes to a head with Trump and Xi?
I think they will have to make something happen there because it doesn't have to happen very quickly. It could be that the Chinese will wait until the election. But in the end, too much is at stake to not have some sort of a trade agreement between America and China.
All right. So here's the big question now. With all that said, with everything we talk about, whether it's the Middle East and Iran or North Korea or China or Russia or what have you, who's the greatest threat to world peace?
You know, I'm almost tempted to say, and this is a little bit out of left field, but I think the greatest threat to world peace is Africa. Because Africa is a continent that is so overpopulated and under-resourced. And there are no solutions right now that anybody in the world has how to deal with that. That in terms of like, if you look at the entire globe and the centers of instability, maybe in the very short term, Iran kind of comes to mind with their crazy theological aspirations and kind of eschatological ideology, but they're not that big. They can be fairly easily contained. When you look at Africa, that to me is just an intractable problem, and it's a ticking bomb that's about to explode and flood the world with millions, tens of millions, and possibly hundreds of millions of migrants, and nobody has the slightest plan in place how to deal with that. And this will create, unfortunately, I think, has all the potential of creating mayhem on a kind of almost unimaginable scale.
Wow. Well, big thank you to Baruch Plettner. And I'll tell you, if you get a sense when you hear Baruch here and you start to see what we're doing here with this program, Five Thought Leaders on World Peace, you begin to think a little bit more as you get the different perspectives of each of these strong opinions and voices here. What an interesting program, and interesting to bring all of these thought leaders to you. And what's most fascinating is you really get a scope of what world peace means to one particular analyst versus another, if you will. And so let's get started and bring on here Ilana Friedman. Ilana is a veteran intelligence analyst. She's a political commentator and host here at America Out Loud. She is an author. I want to tell you about her new book. It's called Hamas, The Story of Islamic Jihad on Israel's Front Lines. A must read, all of Ilana's work is. And you can get that on Amazon or right at the America Out Loud bookstore, friends, where you can get all kinds of great books from all of our experts and authors and terrific guests as well. So what influence do you believe President Trump has, if he remains in office, this is through 2024, in Middle East politics?
Well, the Middle East politics is a very tricky business. And it's not like anything we have here. So for us to apply our Western thinking to Middle East politics, well, it doesn't work. And we've seen over the last decades that it hasn't worked in trying to understand or to solve some of the problems there. And part of the thing that we do not understand is, first of all, this is not an economic issue, because the leaders of the Palestinians, who are at the center of Middle Eastern peace, which would be the Palestinians and Israel, the leaders don't want peace. They want to, and what they have been doing for decades has been to enriching themselves at the expense of their own people, to make clear that you have to have a partner in peace. And with the Palestinians, you have leaders who are dedicated to the destruction of Israel, who was supposed to be their partner in peace, and they don't want it. They want to destroy the state of Israel and take over the land for themselves and, frankly, turn it back into a desert.
All right, looking forward, will Iran become a nuclear state out there? And if they do, what are the consequences of this?
I think they will. I think we're going to try to stop them, but they've been doing so much secretly for so many years. We didn't stop them when they were working with North Korea. That started in long ago, but they actually developed a presence in North Korea in 2012. So they were working over there in order to hide from discovery, and they did a pretty good job of it. What we have to deal with is a government that we also don't understand very well, but their theology says that there has to be, that their Messiah is coming, their 12th Imam, and he is coming, but before he comes, there has to be chaos. And so I think that maybe the Ayatollah believes that he needs to help create the chaos in order to hasten the coming of the 12th Imam. And that is what we are facing, a leader who doesn't want peace, who wants war.
Yeah, that's interesting that you put that out there like that. And that's great. It's a great reminder for everybody to understand that there's an ideology behind these things always, you know, and that ideology is the driving mechanism in these kinds of conflicts, you know. As we look around the world right now, and we look at places and hot spots like the recent visit that the president met to Kim Jong-un and the DMZ. You look at China and their buildup of as a world military. Again, you see all of the flashpoints throughout the Middle East. You see what's happened in Europe now with all of this happening with the European Union and the borders down and up and down and up again. And even look at Africa and some of the areas out in Africa. Who is the greatest threat to world peace?
Honestly, rather than pointing my finger at a state which is agitating, I would point the finger at ourselves for not understanding better what is going on in the world and how we need to address it. We tend to either go very, very far to the left and say, you know, peace in our time and everything will be okay, or we go to the right and we say maybe what we need to be is more militant. But I think what we don't do is really make an effort to understand who the protagonists are on the other side and what is making them tick. Like we just talked about Iran, I think this is something we need to do very seriously, to understand the real dynamics behind the confrontations. And that is the fact that we don't do that, or we don't do it enough, is the real threat to peace.
You know, domestic politics certainly play into world peace. And although not everybody looks at it that way, but it's a major factor. And in recent times here, the gridlock in Congress among liberals and conservatives, many people believe, has absolutely impacted our global leadership position. Let's talk about the future implications for world peace. If this doesn't change, if that gridlock continues, and it gets, I mean, it's pretty extreme now, but continues to get more extreme, how is this going to impact our position for world peace?
Two things here. One is the fact that with our Congress in gridlock, we have a situation where the president is acting unilaterally in many areas, and he's doing a pretty good job. So from that point of view, I think it moves world peace, if there is such a thing, forward. But the other side of it is, what is the perception on this, on the part of the people overseas who are looking at us, who do not understand that this is a problem that maybe can be overcome after the next election? So I would suggest that we have to look at two things, at the fact that the president is moving negotiations along on several fronts. He's keeping several balls in the air, and he's doing a pretty good job. On the other hand, we have to make sure that the people that we're dealing with overseas understand that the gridlock is a shame. It's difficult. It makes life harder for the president and for our government, but it's not, it doesn't make us weaker. It just makes us less effectual in an immediate sense, but over time, it probably will not impact very heavily on the work that the president is doing.
You know, you make me think there when you say, when I mentioned world peace, and you paused a moment and you said, if there is such a thing. And I started to think immediately, you kept talking, but I was thinking to myself, wow, that is a profound question in itself. If here we're doing a whole program on world peace, and you say, if there is such a thing. So let's touch on that a moment, because is there such a thing? And what does world peace look like to you?
I think world peace is an aspiration. It's a dream. I professionally and personally don't think it's possible, because I believe there will always be people who are hungry and who are ravenous for power, for wealth, for all the things that can defeat peace, because they make victims of other people who have what they want. And I don't think this is ever going to go away. This has been with us since the beginning of humankind. There are these people, I don't know how to say that they're going to go away, or that there will be a time when people will be so good and loving and kind that they can get along without anybody. Look at Africa. Africa is in the heat of turmoil because there are people in Africa who want to conquer other people in Africa, and they're willing to kill and rape and destroy in order to achieve the power that they want. And we are now facing something else, Malcolm, which we don't talk about very much because it's not politically correct, but there is an element in the Muslim population that wants to take over the world. This is not conducive to world peace.
So I'm guessing that that doesn't mean we shouldn't continue to strive for it. Let's leave that point to everybody, Ilana, that maybe, I mean, we're going to always try to strive for that, but will we ever really get to what is really truly world peace? That's a tall order, isn't it?
Well, I think what we have to do is continue to strive, continue to aim for the humanitarian approach to life that reaches out to people, that is kind, that is good, that is helpful, that helps people get on their feet and make their lives better. But at the same time, be aware that not everybody feels that way. It doesn't mean we shouldn't strive, though, and I think we should.
Excellent. Excellent answers, yeah. Well, we're going to reach over the ocean right now to Europe, and as we're bringing on another thought leader on world peace. Be back with more Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
say, let the silent voices be heard. Shadow banning, editing, censorship, blocking, and adherence to political correctness are seen as serious threats to our God-given right to free speech. Suppressing free speech, the very cornerstone of our society, is not in the best interest of our listeners, readers, and those who provide our content. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio. As we continue here on the Thought Leaders on World Peace, I'd like to bring on here IQ Al-Razouli. So IQ is an author of Lifting the Veil. You can go to the expert page at America Out Loud and find out a lot more about IQ. Let's start first in our tour here in the Middle East here. And I want to talk about Iran. When you look at Iranian aspirations and how they spread across the Middle East, countries like Syria, Iraq, Lebanon, Yemen, United Arab Emirates, what about Iran's quest? Is part of it to restore sort of a new Persian Empire? What's their ultimate goal there?
When talking about Iranians, one must exclude the majority of the people of Iran who have been actually suffering from the corruption and terror of their mullahs for over 40 years. It is the fundamentalist Shia clerics who run Iran after the fall of the Shah under Khomeini, who aspire to control the Middle East. And this is exactly why they should not ever be allowed to have nuclear weapons under any circumstances.
And they make that pretty clear what their ultimate goal of using a weapon is, clearly. It's difficult to control an enemy that is, you know, pretty okay to die. I mean, they're willing to die for their program, and they make that very clear, IQ. I mean, that's not a hidden agenda, that they put that out there. You talk about the Iranian people a moment here. Let's talk about that a moment here. I don't think a lot of people really understand, and you're bringing up a very big point here up front here, that the Iranian people are by far and large really good people. And it's the leadership, this tyrannical leadership that is bent on destruction and has no compassion for their people. Recently, with the economic conditions and the sanctions that have taken a lot of toll there in Iran, there's been a lot of uprising of the people, and the government is having challenges putting them down a little bit here. How do you see that playing out? Will the Iranian people stand up enough to take some of that control back, or does leadership always keep a muzzle on the country?
They are trying to, but you see, the West is not helping them. The European Union is literally undermining America and Donald Trump in actually helping the mullahs to circumvent what Donald Trump is trying to do. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Number two, the American administration, one after the other, they had a chance, and they still have a chance, and I've said that on your show many times. Mm-hmm. You have Reza Pahlavi, the son of the Shah of Iran. They could approach him and make him a titular, constitutional monarch as a replacement to the Iranian regime. Because the Iranian people must know, should know, that there is an alternative waiting. But nobody is doing anything. So they have no alternative waiting. So how do they overthrow something and they can't know what will replace them?
IQ, there's a reluctancy of America to do what you just put out there. There's a big reluctancy in this country for us to really get involved in internal politics in any country, to foster another leader, to change the, there's a real quandary of our involvement in that. But you're saying that's really the answer to Iran politics, huh?
Absolutely. We're not invading anyone. You're not killing anyone. You're not threatening anyone.
Right.
All you're doing is telling the Iranian people, you have an alternative if you overthrow them. So at least they will have somebody waiting to take over and you have a stable relationship.
Yeah.
Look what happened in Iraq. Look what happened in Libya. Obama overthrew governments and didn't replace them with anybody.
Well, because then the problem with that is we end up in a nation-building status. And that's always a conflict back here in the United States, because we do that around the world. And there are a lot of people here who want hands-off foreign policy like this. So it's a really tricky, tricky conversation. In the picture of Iran, do you see them at all moderating or any sort of revolutionary change in this leadership? Do you see that this can happen on its own? Is there any way that the people can rise? And if nobody does intervene, do you see any change in this?
Well, first of all, the people may rise, but the government of Iran, the mullahs, they have two types of armies, a regular army and the army which protects them. And the army which protects the mullahs is superior to the army which is the standard army. You see, it's an oxymoron talking about Sharia-compliant Muslims or Islam and moderation. Since there is not a single moderate verse in Muhammad's Quran from over 6,200 verses that has any mercy or compassion towards non-Muslim kuffar infidels, currently 80% of humanity. Mm-hmm. So it's very, very tricky wording when people speak about moderate Islam. It doesn't exist. It cannot exist.
Do you think Iran gets a nuclear weapon at some point, or do we keep it away from them?
Iran must never become nuclear. They are the ones, as you said a few minutes ago, who keep shouting to the world for 40 years, we love death while you, non-Muslim, love life.
That's it. Yeah. If everybody understands what IQ puts out there, see, that's the ideology again. If you can't change that, you can't change an ideology. It's a belief system. And if that's their belief system and they're willing to die for it, then all bets are off, isn't it now, right? Absolutely. And that's where we're at, right?
Yes, 100%.
Yeah, that's where we're at. Let's move over to Russia a moment here. I want to talk to you about Russia. Now, this is a topic that you and I have had engaged many times in conversation, and you're very passionate about this particular relationship. So I want to ask you, let me remind people that Russia is still today the second largest nuclear power in the world. All right. How does America forge a working relationship with the Russians at this point with all the damage that's been done?
No damage has been done, believe me. Russia under Putin can and should be a better ally than the Soviets could have ever been. Mm-hmm. After all, in the 21st century, the most dangerous entity after Islam and Muslims is China, with its 1.3 billion population, her strong economy, and remarkable advances in technology and the military. The USA, Russia, and Europe put together will barely be able to match 21st century China. Had it not been for the deranged Democrats, mm-hmm. Russia would have already been a good friend of the USA, especially under President Trump. I am not afraid of Russia. Russia has been contained. They are not looking for empires anymore. China is huge difference.
Right. That spells it out pretty good. Why do you think a good part of the leadership here in the United States, why have they used Russia in such a way and made a mockery out of that relationship?
Because they're stupid. What can I tell you? They are not American. Let me explain something to you. I'm the outsider looking in. I'm more American than all 23 representatives who are trying to be president of the United States of America. Because each and every one of them wants open border. Each and every one wants to have equality between illegals and legals. I don't stand for that. I stand for the American Constitution.
Yeah, that is an ongoing battle here, for sure, IQ. All right, so when we look around the world right now, we look at the recent meeting with Kim Jong-un, and we look at China, you just mentioned, and what taking place, China, Russia, the Middle East, Iran, Africa. You look at all of the hotspots around the world right now. Let's step back a moment. Tell me, who's the greatest threat to world peace?
Islam is by far the greatest threat to non-Muslim humanity, as they are terrorizing every country on earth, on five continents. In fact, the most persecuted people in the 21st century are Christians by Muslims, and all the criminal Western media. Not only are they deafeningly silent, but adding insult to injury, misleading hundreds of millions of people regarding the existential threat caused by fundamentalist Muslims to all of humanity. This is not an exaggeration, this is a fact of life. Every single day, there are attacks against non-Muslims anywhere and everywhere in Europe and in America and in Africa and in Asia and in Southern North America. Every single day, Muslims are doing it.
Yeah.
Not Christians, not Buddhists, not Hindus, and not Jews.
When you hear IQ speak about this, I want to remind people something that's important here. You know, this conversation that he and I are just having here, many people would say that it's not a politically correct conversation, clearly, because we're identified who an enemy is and you hear his opinion there. But let me remind everyone listening here that IQ knows this culture better than anybody on the program. He was born in Baghdad. He understands the culture. He grew up there. He knows what takes place. That's why his books spell out the culture as he talks about it. And you'll see many of his write-ins. He's dedicated his life to informing people. 5 thought leaders on world peace. And let's bring on now George McClellan. George is a historian. He's a political analyst. His professional career spans 43 years in law enforcement and the U.S. Naval Investigative Service. He is a weekly columnist at America Out Loud, and I refer to him also as a national treasure. And if you read his write-ins back on the platform, he's been with us quite some time. You'll enjoy the reads as George tells it like it is. And we like people who do that. Let's continue on here. So as we've continued around the world and we've looked at world peace here, George, let's talk about Afghanistan a moment specifically. The president has really been, he's really been challenged with trying to pull the troops down and with an eventual goal of trying to get out of Afghanistan. And there are a lot of people who would like to see that. What does Afghanistan look like if we did pull out completely, and could we pull out completely?
Historically, no occupying army has ever conquered or stayed long in Afghanistan. The British were kicked out twice. The Russians, they got handed their hat. Why? Because Afghanistan is a tribal country. The tribes reside in little valleys separated by high mountains, and they hate one another. And soon as anybody leaves, they're going to go back to their tribalism and start fighting one another again. If we pull out, and we're going to do it because Trump says we need to do it. We've been in that country 17 years, and we've accomplished what? Nothing. The Afghan army, I think, is for the government, the Afghan army for the existing government, is a facade. It's just there now. They're being killed by the Taliban. The Taliban is not a tribe. It is the adherents of Islam, and Islam is the driving force right now that will see the Taliban take over again. And once the Taliban takes over the government, that government will collapse. You have to remember, too, that back in the 40s and the 50s, Afghanistan was a forward-looking country in the big cities, not in the tribal areas. Women went without veils. Women were educated. There are many examples of educated women from Afghanistan who are have PhDs and teach at universities. They're not stupid people, but they are tribal people, and they're locked into their misery because of Islam. And Islam in that country will prevail. It has to prevail. Yeah.
There are a lot of leaders, military leaders, based on what you would say right there, who would argue back, George, and they would say, well, you either fight them there or you fight them here. Now, you've laid out a pretty good scenario there of how really screwed up the environment is in Afghanistan and what we're dealing with. But what do you think about that when they put that out there, either fight them here or fight them there? What do you say to that?
Well, we're talking about Afghanistan. So are we going to see Afghanistan tribal fighters in America? We're fighting Islam. Islam is fighting them. And Islam comes in the shape of Saudi Arabians, Kuwaitis, Syrians, Iraqis, Iranians. We're fighting a religion and a way of life. We're not fighting Afghanistan. So if they want to come here, they'll probably want to come here to live as Americans, as I see it. I know a couple of Afghanistans I've met who like being here, and they do not like the Taliban idea.
Interesting. I think people can see the thread right now with just before you, we had IQ Al Razuli on, and you can see the thread of where George just went. It should give you all pause and make you think just a moment here. Let's bring it back a little bit here domestically. I want to talk to you about the 2020 race here, the presidential candidates. There's been a real suggestion to cut military spending for many of the presidential candidates. Talk to us a moment how this would impact world peace, please.
Well, America is the predominant world military power. 8 years of Obama saw that power reduced. Ronald Reagan told us that you have to have peace through strength. Mm-hmm. That was his basic motto, peace through strength. You don't have to use it. You just have to be able to threaten to use it. These people want to take military spending and give it to social programs like housing the poor, the indigent, the millions of refugees pouring across our borders. That's where they want to use our money. They don't see us being the policemen of the world. And we are, by default, have become the policemen of the world. Russia can't do it. They're flexing their muscles now by sending one destroyer, a new modern destroyer with stealth technology, to Cuba. It showed up in Cuba yesterday. Is that it? One? We can send an aircraft carrier, through 3 or 4 to Cuba, to show the difference in strength. Russia can't afford a war. They can't afford to help China, though.
Yeah, so you're saying by default, you lay out a pretty good story there. In other words, there's a price and a consequence for being a superpower, isn't there now, George, right? Right? I mean,
There is indeed. There is indeed. And China's facing that now. China is challenging the world, us, and so is North Korea and Venezuela. These challenges came under the Obama regime, administration. Then there's the Al-Qaeda and the ISIS groups. That's why we're in these little endless wars in the Middle East. It's good to have them there, but why should we be over there fighting them? But we're there because we have to be. Somebody has to do it.
All right, so let's step back just a moment here. Recently, we've been hearing words of another military branch called the Space Force. President Trump surprised a lot of people when he said that we would be developing this other military force. And a lot of people were thinking Star Wars kind of thing right away. But really, it's about the fact that we are at a risk in space with our satellites and technical capabilities, if that was ever damaged or put out, the risk to our armed forces and to our structure here, the integrity of our structure would be compromised greatly. So is it time for this new military force, the Space Force? Is this a branch of military that is needed and whose time has come?
Most assuredly, we need to be in space. China's on a fast track to get there. They've already launched and put somebody on, not somebody, but they've already gone to the moon and maybe Mars, I think, possibly. But they're working to put a space station in orbit. Once they get in orbit, you know, China was once a vast empire. And then it broke up into its pieces. And then every European country seemed to march through China to get what they could out of it. And China has been poor for so long. Now China is not poor anymore. And China wants hegemony over the Pacific Ocean. Indeed, they want it over the world. That's why you find Chinese paying off governments who are bankrupt to have ports in their countries, their seaside countries. And they're doing that. They're going to be... China is trying to be an empire again. Xi, he is now the premier for life. They have no democracy there at all. He wants to be a kind of a titular emperor of a new China, and China is going to be expanded. They have their own social problems within their country, but so does everybody. They'll get to that. But he's the supreme leader, and they're going back. Like Putin wants a czarist Russia with him as the czar. China wants an imperial China, and they're going to get there. But China does not want to share world hegemony with anybody else, especially the U.S. They want it all.
Just been talking about China. We talk about Russia. We talk about North Korea, Iran, Africa, other hot spots around the globe here. In your opinion, who's the greatest threat to world peace?
Islam, followed by the Democrat Party.
Well, let's talk about that a moment. The Democrat Party versus Islam. I mean, wait a minute now. That's two interesting forces you throw out there. Out of those two, which is the bigger risk? Let me ask you that.
Well, for America right now, it's the Democrat Party, because they're rotting us out. They're weakening us from the inside. If you look at, they failed to take over the government through the election of Hillary Clinton, which they thought they had. But they are taking over the government in cities and states all over America. And many of these, Portland, Oregon, for example, has gone completely leftist, completely leftist. The Antifa's run riot in the street, beating up people in Portland, Oregon, and nobody stops them. Absolutely nobody stops them. If every city in large city in America suddenly has leftist leadership, and I'm looking also at San Francisco, Los Angeles, Seattle, Portland, New York City, then they're going to start changing the government from the inside, and they will eventually get elected into the presidency and the Congress, and then we're gone forever. That's the plan. On top of that, many of these cities, particularly up in the north right now, the city councils are being legally elected by Muslims, and Muslims are taking over a lot of those smaller towns, Dearborn, Michigan, for example. Mm-hmm. So, yes, we have a problem. Nobody wants the old America anymore. These people all want the new America, their America, their socialist America. And it'll be years and years of misery.
Well, George, thank you. Big thank you here to George McClellan. And thank you to all of our thought leaders here, Colonel Jim Warshak, Baruch Plettner, Ilana Friedman, IQ Al Razuli, George McClellan. You know, friends, when we think of world peace, I want to say to you, you know, I woke up the other day thinking, I woke up with this concept of doing this show today, Five Thought Leaders on World Peace. And what dawned on me is that, you know, when you look around the world right now and you see the interactions and the decision-making of Donald Trump right now, I'm not certain at all that he's getting the credit for much of the world peace that we're seeing right now. I mean, when a president makes a decision to meet someone like a Kim Jong-un, a dictator, a ruthless dictator, at the DMZ, which came under a lot of criticism from the other side, but what's the alternative, friends? Would they rather have a nuclear war or explosion somewhere? And then those same people would be asking all kinds of questions, wouldn't they? So when you start to take a look at what he's done with China and forging the relationship with Xi Jinping, you see what he's done with Japan and the relationship with Abe, and you see the relationship he's done with the Middle East and with Israel, and the way he's held Iran at bay. And so it began to really dawn on me that this president has not gotten the credit whatsoever for his foreign policy. And quite frankly, looking at past relationships, it dawned on me that, you know, this president, if any president ever deserved a Nobel Prize, if that means anything, to some maybe it does, to others maybe not, this president, surely, the fact that he wants peace, the fact that he strives for peace, the fact that that's his goal, his ultimate objective, the fact that he's not out there nation building, he's not out there trying to cause trouble around the world, that speaks volumes. It should speak volumes to every American, because that really is the definition of world peace when you look at this president. So listen, whatever the prize is, this president, as far as I can see, and it really deserves that understanding and acknowledgement from the American people, I believe, that world peace, and world peace, as was pointed out on this show, is a mindset. It's a mindset, people. But it's something that we always should strive for, even though you ask yourself, is world peace ever really obtainable? I mean, you think about that in humankind and human conditions, and you can probably come up with your own answer to that question, can't you now? Well, it's great having you with us here on the journey here on Viewpoint, friends. And remember, as always, it's time for you to get involved and get out.